Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the legal challenges against COVID vaccine mandates, death statistics and testing, and an ongoing state of emergency. My guest, Anna Gardner, lawyer. She holds a degree in biology from the University of New Mexico, and she received her jurisprudence degree from the University of Mexico's Law School. Later, her experience in medical litigation earned her a position at the university's law school. She is now leading the state's stand-up mission to challenge the government's overreaching programs that have been depriving Americans of their liberties and contributing to untold physical, mental, and economic hardships. Following graduation, Anna pursued a law practice in medical malpractice and injuries. Last December, she and three other attorneys filed a case against New Mexico's governor and state public health officials on the handling of COVID pandemic cases. She is also a party for a similar lawsuit filed in Ohio that includes the CDC, the Department of Health and Human Services, for misreporting deaths as COVID. Her group's website is nmsstandsup.org. Nice to have you with us, Diana.
Thank you, Gary, for having me.
Many of us in this audience, and we have a lot of scientists, physicians, nurses, people in the public health field, academics, are concerned because it seems as if this runaway wreck of a train is being directed right over a cliff. When you have more children dying of suicide in a given year, 2020, and now increasing 2021, than you have from COVID, then what is the point of punishing these children when all of the actual science from peer-reviewed literature shows that they do not have to be quarantined? To the contrary, they first started off, Anthony Fauci and others, by proclaiming wear a mask, social distance, proper hygiene, and stay quarantined. I agree with proper hygiene. That's just common sense above and beyond anything anyone could reasonably do in their own life is to be hygienic. But then I ask, where is the actual science to determine that if you're 3 feet, 6 feet, 20 feet away from someone, that is protective? Where's the science on the masks? Knowing the size of most viruses are smaller than the best mask that we have to prevent that kind of viral transmission. Now, there are other things that can be blocked by a mask, and depending upon the rating of that mask and how much it filters, there may be justification. But we're not talking about having science first and then public policy based on science. We're having public policy then looking for the science that justifies it. It's much like the weapons of mass destruction. We're sure that if we don't find them, there'll be a, what did Condoleezza Rice say, a mushroom cloud over our heads? But it didn't happen. As a scientist myself, who's published a lot of peer-reviewed literature and done over 46 clinical studies, and a senior research fellow at the Institute of Applied Biology and head of the anti-aging department, I read science every day. And I'm appalled by what I have seen. I'm appalled at the lack of care of human beings for human beings when the bureaucracy, in my opinion, has went ahead with policies that are highly political, they're economic, but they're not science-driven. Therefore, you step in and say, let's take a more honest look. Now, you couldn't be filing these lawsuits if you had not first done your homework. So please take your time. There's no commercial interruptions here. And lay out for us what you discovered that led you to believe that you had to file a lawsuit in the state of New Mexico and then a supporting lawsuit in Ohio. The form is yours.
Thank you, Gary. I agree with you entirely that children have been disproportionately impacted by the measures that have been taken to, quote, control this deadly disease, as they call it. When I started researching the science, though, what I found out is case numbers and numbers of deaths attributed to COVID were based upon a test that it was not meant to diagnose SARS-CoV virus. These PCR tests, as everyone knows what they are, I'll let you pronounce the what the PCR actually stands for, but the PCR test invented by Carrie Mullis years ago was designed to amplify DNA so that it could be detected in various applications. I know that they've used it in forensic settings, but here they developed the PCR test in the absence of having any virus that was the causal agent of this disease. They also developed it without regard to any sort of gold standard in terms of what cycle threshold, that's the number of amplifications that each test goes through, what cycle threshold is the most ideal threshold for even detecting any amount of viral load that could potentially be infectious. And so, you know, we have a couple of problems with the PCR test. Number one, it's not designed to detect specifically SARS-CoV, which is the alleged agent of COVID disease. And in the package inserts themselves, they claim that a positive result doesn't mean necessarily that you have COVID, but that we can be picking up a number of other types of viruses, including influenza, flu, and Ebola. Well, that's just, you know, not a very specific test. And these tests aren't correlated with clinical symptoms, which that never occurs where you diagnose somebody or call them a case without clinical correlation. So there's been a lot of fudging in the science. And when I started looking at the basis underlying the declaration of public health emergency, I realized it was based on a lot of unscientific principles. And I agree with you. Where is the science? Where's the science that says we're supposed to stand 6 feet away? Well, that happens to be 2 meters in European distancing, the way that they measure it. And so it's a very easy measurement. 2 meters, 6 feet. Okay, everybody can remember that, but is it really valid? The other thing about the mask wearing, there's no scientific evidence at all that the mask wearing prevents any type of transmission for this particular virus. I heard a friend recently say, it's a little bit like trying to use your chain link fence to keep mosquitoes out of your yard. And it's just, there's no scientific basis for it. There was a large study done in Vietnam, healthcare workers, years before the COVID outbreak happened. So we can probably assume that maybe that science was not biased because there wasn't any incentive at that time to have a biased report on mask wearing for healthcare providers. And what it said is that, no, it doesn't really prevent you from getting anything. And then the CDC also came out with its own study about mask wearing, saying that those people who wore masks often or frequently were more likely to get a serious case of some disease, some respiratory disease that they're attributing to COVID, than those who wore a mask rarely or never. So we've got a lot of evidence out there that makes me question this entire narrative. And, you know, like I say, it's disproportionately impacting children. It's crashing our economies in the states that have instituted these terrible lockdowns and restrictions on how many people can come into a business. So we've got a lot of problems that have emanated from a false premise, and that is that the PCR test even has any reliability whatsoever. And of course, Gary, I think you're probably aware of this, that there hasn't been any excess death count. The deaths have been pretty steady in America year to year, including the year of the COVID 2020. We don't have excess deaths. What we probably have is that a lot of deaths that would have been attributed to the other causes of deaths, heart disease, diabetes, cancer, trauma, those deaths instead have been coded, it appears, they have been coded as being reported as COVID deaths. And so we know that there's a big problem with the numbers.
You and your colleagues are now the first attorneys to file a lawsuit challenging the legality of mandatory COVID vaccines. The case involves a correction facilities officer who was being threatened to be vaccinated or lose his job. So this case would establish a precedent if you win. and then hopefully other states will follow suit. My other main concern will be schools and colleges that will start to mandate these vaccines before students can return to classes in the fall. Rutgers University in New Jersey has recently implemented this rule. So without getting too focused on the specifics of this lawsuit, within the larger scope of all the hardships that people have been facing with lockdowns and loss of income, what would be the precedent you hope to establish in next? Could this be the start of a new challenges to other falsehoods and lies our health officials are feeding to the public? And I'll give you five areas that you may want to address, any one of these or all of them. One, you mentioned the PCR test, polymerase chain reaction. Up on my website, GaryNoll.com, and on PRN.fm, you will see the nearly two-hour interview with Dr. Kerry Mullis. I interviewed him in 1996 on this topic. He makes it very clear. First, he makes it clear his contempt for the scientific judgment of Anthony Fauci, who was running the war on AIDS at the time, along with Robert Gallo. But he makes it very clear that this is not a specific test. It is only important in that whatever you're looking for, you will find it if you continue to magnify something thousands, millions, even billions of times. You'll find it. It does not mean, however, that because you have found a part of a virus that you can be specific as to which virus it is. It doesn't do that. Or whether it's pathogenic. It doesn't do that. But at the lower amplifications, let's say under 20, you may indeed be positive for a particular virus, but then you have to have a separate independent confirmation test to determine, is it pathogenic? Do you have symptoms? Because we now know that most of the people, this is part two, who have been called by the New York Times and others following suit, cases, these are not people who necessarily are sick. In fact, the vast majority are not. I'll give you an analogy that I thought about. Let's just say that the more people you test for COVID, the more people are going to test positive. On a faulty test that could be upwards of 90% wrong in either direction, false positive, false negative. But the vast majority of people will test positive but not be sick. They have a strong innate immune system, and then there's the adaptive immune system that either with a vaccine or with the molecule itself, your body mounts a defense and creates some form of immunity. So most people, especially younger people and healthier people, they probably have been infected and no symptoms, and therefore they're immune. So by the best medical judgment I can find in America, and we had it on this program earlier this week, the most cited scientist, medical doctor in the world on cardiology and nephrology says that like he, his wife and child, parents were sick with COVID, they all recovered. They don't need the vaccine. They're immune. So when that kind of person, orthodox pro-vaccine person, says we're over-vaccinating, he has science on his side. He doesn't have politics and he doesn't have public opinion. He doesn't have the media. So that may be an argument that is moot. He may lose it, even though he is right. So we are over-counting actual cases of COVID. Third point, who really has the disease that has caused them to die? All the initial studies showed that 2.6 comorbidities, including upper respiratory tract infections, emphysema, frequently from people who are heavy smokers, heart disease, diabetes, and obesity, are all comorbidities. If you have 2.6 of these, you're in a much higher level of contracting the virus and dying. But those are people that they found over 70% were already in nursing homes, hospice centers, or facilities where they were dying and would die no matter what. And so how can you legitimately count those as part of the pandemic when the vast majority of people and virtually 99.99% of all children and youth will not die of this, and the annual influenza has a higher lethality than this? So they've conflated a false positive to a case, to a disease, and therefore justifying the pandemic lockdowns. So that should be challenged. And finally, on the fifth one is now, and this is to me the most important, any legitimate vaccine, you should do at least 5 years of research with animals and clinical studies to see, does it work against an authentic placebo of a saline solution? We're not doing that. So the most important foundational issue in medicine is the precautionary principle. First, prove that what you're doing will not harm and we be efficacious. That's being completely overlooked, and the 95% efficacy is a fraud. Real science will show you that's not the case. And so we are then not looking at ivermectin. We're not looking at hydroxychloroquine. We're not looking at vitamin D, vitamin C, zinc, and selenium as natural ways of defending. And yet there are over now 270 studies, many peer-reviewed, many double-blind, showing that ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine can prevent up to 90% of people who have the actual infection going into hospital, who are in hospital, upwards of 50% will not die. That means then, in just lay language, that minimal of 80% of all deaths could have been prevented had they used these well-known drugs that were off-label at the beginning, but they chose not to, and therefore that means that the people who were pushing the vaccines and no other treatment, no other prevention, which was in the peer review literature, and what is their motive for having done that? Those are the questions I'd like for you, if you can, and the importance of those being addressed in a lawsuit. Would you address those, please?
Yes, I'll be happy to. And I agree with you that the whole premise on which this pandemic is based needs to be challenged. And we did challenge it. We are challenging it in our first lawsuit that we filed against the governor of New Mexico and the public health director. We are challenging it based on exactly what you set forth. And it's that most of these, quote, cases aren't even people who are symptomatic. They don't have symptoms. You know, we've got a 90% false positive rate for these PCR tests. We have overly inflated numbers. And I'm going to skip around in terms of your numbers that you set out issues, because they're all so overlapping. But what we also have is that not only do we have this overinflation of case numbers and then also deaths, the CDC, you were citing really part of what their study showed, that there was 2.6 on average comorbidities of the people who did die from something. But when the CDC went back and checked it all, there were only 6% of all of those deaths that died with no comorbidities, which would indicate that maybe they did have COVID. 6% of all of the deaths may have actually been attributable to the disease. And as you say, that is a lower mortality rate than the seasonal flu. That's not a pandemic. This is more of a case-demic that has exaggerated the numbers and caused fear and hysteria and panic amongst people. And it's had a terrible effect. It's separated families because they're in one camp or the other in terms of how much research they do or whether they get their information just from, let's say, the television. That's not going to provide you with accurate information. You've got to do your own research. And I'm so glad that there are people like you, Gary, who are out there doing the research and the natural remedies that are available that have a high effectiveness rate. And, you know, that brings us to the issue of if we have some safe products like ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine that have been tried for years without serious side effects for most people, and they've been shown to be effective and, you know, pretty safe, why aren't those being used instead of vaccines that are being rolled out at, quote, warp speed, certainly without the animal testing that's necessary, without the consideration of the types of reactions that are happening? And the shot may be more dangerous than the disease ever was, because most people survive the disease. Most people who get it survive it. It's got an overall, as you say, 99.9% survivability rate. That's not a scary pandemic. It's really just about as bad as a bad flu season. most of us who are healthy will survive. We don't, you know, a lot of us don't take flu shots because we know that we'd rather take our chances with a flu. And it's, you know, we're fine most years. And if we get the flu, we get over it and we have a stronger immunity system. I agree with you about all of that. And that's why we've challenged the state of the public health emergency with the governor and the public health director. And then in the suit where we're challenging the mandated emergency use authorization investigational products. That's what these injections are. They are investigational. They're still in clinical trials. They have not been proven to be safe or effective. And I agree with you that this 95% efficacy rate that they're claiming, or effectiveness rate, is they've basically done a little smoke screen with the numbers and how they've come up with it. And I won't go into detail because it'd be boring to anyone who's not really a mathematician or, you know, a scientist. But I understand that the numbers have been fudged as well, even in this. So what we're looking at is to stop the mandate, because it's really against federal law. The federal law of the emergency use authorization, under which these products are allowed to even be used. And that applies to the PCR test, and it applies to the injections by the Pfizer, Moderna, AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson, you know, whoever else is. I think there might be one more I'm forgetting. I thought there were about five of them. But so far, these types of numbers are supporting using a dangerous drug on people. And why would healthy people line up like they have been? Why would healthy people line up to take this injection that has more of a risk if you're young, especially if you're under 65? You know, it's not worth the risk, because most people under 65 without a lot of comorbidities are going to survive COVID just fine, especially if they get to a doctor who knows about the treatments, the effective treatments that are out there. So it seems as if all of this is a political, I'd have to say that it appears very politically driven to have us have the fear of this disease. It's not as deadly as they represent. The PCR tests are wrong. The cases, number of cases are wrong. There is no such thing as asymptomatic transmission. And that was shown in an almost 10 million person study that came out of Wuhan just not too long ago. I think it was in November that it came out. And they found that they identified about 300 people who may have gotten COVID or did get COVID from somebody who was contagious and infected and symptomatic. And of those 300 people, not one of them transmitted it, and none of the asymptomatic people transmitted it, I should say. None of the other asymptomatic people who were tested, who had even been in close contact with symptomatic people, none of them transmitted the disease. So Fauci has come out and said, well, you know, these injections may not prevent you from getting COVID, and furthermore, it doesn't appear to prevent transmission of COVID. Well, that's actually coming true. I recently ran across an article that said three Hawaiian women who got their full set of COVID injections came down with COVID just within about 30 days of the injections. So it clearly doesn't prevent you from getting it. And if it doesn't prevent you from transmitting it, why are people getting it? It doesn't make any sense to me. I think that there's been so much fear and negative programming that's happened to people, and they either believe what they're being told without investigating the facts themselves, or they just have their heads in the sand because they're so fearful and they don't think that they have any empowerment to really stand up against it. I don't know. I don't know what the reason is. But what I do know is
I'd sure. like to add one more thing into the equation, if for you to address, please. Now you're also involved in a lawsuit filed in Ohio that has named the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services and the CDC and the National Centers for Health Statistics as defendants. This seems to be a very important case, whether or not it succeeds, because we are dealing with intentionally deceiving the public about the death statistics during the pandemic. That can be easily proven and has been. You see, historically, I'm sure in your own practice, you will find that the vast majority of physicians and scientists and nurses are reluctant to take on their institutions or the very practice of medicine. People stay kind of close to home when it comes to protecting their futures and their income. In my entire career, I've never seen the outpouring of orthodox, pro-vaccine, pro-orthodox medicine physicians and scientists coming together to say, this is wrong about COVID, this is wrong about COVID, this is wrong about COVID, you got it wrong. And even though they're pro-vaccine and pro-medicine, I mean, think of it. We're up to almost 60,000 scientists and physicians signing the Great Barrington Proclamation, which was founded by a professor at Harvard, a professor at Stanford, and a professor at Oxford universities. There are thousands upon thousands of doctors using ivermectin, using vitamin D and vitamin C and zinc, and using hydroxychloroquine, and their patients are doing great, and yet they've all been attacked. There are those people who are pro-vaccine, but they don't believe this has proven itself to be safe and effective. As you said, we won't know that for several years. But now we have a gross discrepancy between the mortality rate and injury rate in the United States as compared to the European Union, keeping in mind that we're the number one vaccinated country in the world with more vaccines than anyone else. We started earlier than anyone else. As a result, Europe, which is far behind us in total number of vaccines, has almost triple the amount of injuries and deaths. Well, that can't be a statistical anomaly. It's called idiopathic, of unknown origin. There is definitely a substrate of statistics being manipulated, because you can't have the number one group of people taking the vaccines and yet other countries taking it and ours be so low compared to everyone else. We should actually be more than anyone else if we've had the most vaccines, most people. So this is where you have to question everything the CDC puts out. Now, you said, and you were correct, that both the FDA and CDC acknowledge that the number of cases of people dying from COVID by itself without comorbidities was 6%. That meant that 97% of the people, or not, excuse me, 94% of the people were not dying from COVID by itself. That would not make it a pandemic. There would be no need to rush out to make vaccines. We could properly deal that with prevention and with the treatments we do have. But when you go so far as to attack everyone, even Nobel Prize winners in the field and top professors, all orthodox, they're all sitting at the same table. This is what's phenomenal. It's like 100,000 scorpions in a giant fishbowl fighting each other. So we've never seen ultra-orthodox fight ultra-orthodox, because generally ultra-orthodox will not come to your defense, not stand up, not protest, not open themselves up to criticism or cancellation unless they're absolutely certain that there's a real good reason to make that sacrifice. And yet they're making that sacrifice, and every day it's new ones. I'll give you just one example, and this is just from the last hour. This is on ivermectin. Pharmacy Magazine UK touts ivermectin's positive potential targeting COVID-19. These are orthodox sources, by the way. Quote, top Yale doctor, an MD, PhD, and researcher, who's published over 300 papers in the peer-reviewed journal, quote, ivermectin works, including for the long-haul COVID. The Yale University professor and renowned cancer researcher has pored over COVID-19 literature and treated dozens of patients, and he says it works. British ivermectin recommendations development panel response to EMA, a statement on ivermectin COVID-19, quote, On March 22nd, the European Medicines Agency, that's the official agency overseeing all medicine in Europe, that would be like our FDA and CDC combined, issued a statement that after reviewing the evidence, they recommended it against the use of ivermectin. Why? Politics. Because there's political control. And yet we have ivermectin works from the other professors and clinicians using it. And this is another National Institutes of Health update. It's COVID-19 recommendations, and you have everyone on one side of the equation. Vaccine says don't use anything else. Don't worry about prevention, vitamin C, nothing. Ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine will attack those, but then only wait for the vaccines. And we've seen thousands upon thousands of deaths and hundreds of thousands and hundreds of thousands of injuries. Some will be permanent, and that's just after the first few weeks. Imagine after a year from now when most of those adverse effects manifest. So how in the world, as a lawyer, do you look at a situation where you have the pro-vaccine group and nothing else they accept, and they attack anyone, any institution, any article, any research that shows there's a natural non-lethal, very safe drugs and treatments, and what we could do naturally ourselves, and those are completely diverse groups, even though they're all ultra-orthodox. Your thoughts, please.
My thoughts on this is that everything is done for a reason. The suppression of healthy alternatives and preventive measures is purposeful. And it's purposeful because you cannot get an emergency use authorization for a rushed drug, a drug rushed to market, without also a finding by the government agency that there is no safe alternative treatment. This is tied in with the law. It's tied in with what they have to prove or what they have to establish to, you know, a reasonable level that there are no safe alternatives or safe treatments for this disease. This is why they're suppressed. What baffles me is why good doctors, I'm sure that most people who are in the healthcare profession went into this profession because they sincerely wanted to help people. I know that there are good doctors out there. So that makes me wonder why good doctors are going along with a narrative that they have to know is false. And are they being pressured by employers? I've had a lot of whistleblowers contact me, Gary, and I know for a fact that the doctors are being pressured in their jobs. They're being pressured to encourage others to get this vaccine. It's an injectable. I'm not going to dignify it by calling it a vaccine, but they're being pressured to do this. I don't know if the parties giving the vaccine or the injectable get some sort of monetary kickback or, you know, exactly what's happening. I'm very eager to get to that level in the lawsuit where we can get discovery and find out about it. But we know that the CDC changed the rules for reporting of deaths in March of 2020, and they changed the rule that had been in effect for 17 years, and it only pertains to deaths by COVID, deaths with COVID. And they didn't distinguish that particular death from its comorbidities. So, or they did, rather. And so they didn't list the comorbidities and the things that really caused the death as cause number one. They changed the way that the deaths were reported and statistically gathered, and the way coroners were supposed to report these deaths. So they resulted that from the Human Health and Services Department, of which the CDC is included, that resulted in intentionally misrepresenting the number of deaths. And they knew it. They actually put out a memo saying, we know that changing the way we report these deaths is going to result in an over-reporting of deaths attributable to COVID. This was intentional. It's hidden there in laws that very few people would even look at unless they're lawyers. You know, all of these things relate to one another. And we're just trying to untangle some of that, how they relate and why they're doing this. Much of it baffles me. I don't have the answers, We haven't gotten to the discovery stage in any of our lawsuits yet. We're still fighting basic battles in them.
Anna, you do realize that you have limited resources. You have limited capacities without discovery and without depositions. And yet at the same time that you are being limited, there was a really good, I think 17 years ago, the Federal Health Agency put a system in place to monitor statistics regarding health injuries and death. That system seems to have worked very well for the last 20 years. However, for COVID, as you mentioned, they implemented an entirely new system for monitoring this. I can find very little concise details about it, except that it is new. It overrides the system that has worked in the past, and it has never been peer-reviewed and properly evaluated to our knowledge. You're familiar with that. You just alluded to it.
Yes.
And that's because it would seem to be part of the Center for Health Statistics, and that might have been a situation where they had to control everything around them. They control the media. You can't get an honest, in my opinion, an honest and objective and fair-minded accounting of why people would be hesitant about taking this particular vaccine when they have been open to taking all other vaccines. They attack everyone as if everyone is a conspiracy theorist and or a nut job. They do not bring in to interview the thousands of doctors, medical doctors, and scientists who would offer legitimate and science-based challenges to any part of the COVID narrative. They do not allow that argument. So everything in the mainstream media and all of its pundits are merely propagandizing. They're not educating. There's no room for an open, honest debate. And then they're going further. There's a new form of medical McCarthyism where they're attacking individuals and they're setting up whole groups now to have only pro-vaccine, pro-Fauci, pro-orthodoxy information. They're now even proposing a truth czar. Could you imagine in such a corrupt administration, and all administrations are corrupt, left or right, doesn't matter, but to have one person who says, that's wrong and you should be punished, therefore it would destroy all journalism. Already, when you look at our best journalists, our very best, Chris Hedges, Matt Taibbi, Glenn Greenwald, Max Blumenthal, Cheryl Atkinson, as just some of them, Abby Martin, they have all been censored. They can't get up on any of the other sites. They've been deplatformed, and then they've been attacked to attack them so they don't have a source of income that is reliable. And yet they've had the courage and the state of mind and character to stand firm and fight back. Now, as Matt Taibbi is writing in particular, if you did challenge any of the ludicrous statements from the New York Times reporters, then they go into this whole self-pitying, I'm a victim. No, you're a powerful person at the New York Times, and you attack people. You attack whole groups of people. You've never interviewed those people. You're making assumptions that these are misinformed, conspiracy theorists, QAnon people, when nothing could be further from the truth. The most articulate, intelligent voices on the planet are saying there are various parts of this agenda that we've gotten wrong, and yet you take the whole agenda or you take none of it. No criticism allowed. That should rankle all of the lawyers and jurists in this country to stand up and start to support your efforts. So what are you thinking as an individual? I'm only asking that now, Anna, and Anna Gardner's my guest, as an individual, knowing that when you take on Anthony Fauci, because when you take on the U.S. Public Health Service, Anthony Fauci is a part of that. In fact, he's the highest paid public servant in the United States in government. You're taking on the most powerful scientist in the world. In my opinion, the most incompetent and the most reckless. But you're taking on where they have thousands of lawyers. They have the entire media to destroy you. They have social media to deplatform you. And they can keep you locked up in litigation indefinitely because some of the judiciary, not all, is compromised because it is ideological and political rather than constitutional in its ethics. Your response, please.
Well, I do sometimes feel like the David fighting the Goliath when I am taking on cases of this magnitude. These cases are important, very important public interest lawsuits. I've had an outpouring of support and you know, prayers and well wishes from people all over the country, if not the world, saying, I'm so glad somebody's doing something, because people don't know what to do. And what I tell them to do is, you know in your heart what the right thing to do is, you know, and if for you, after researching this, it is not right for you to have this injection, whether you might lose your job or not, stand your ground, because if everybody stands their ground, they're not going to be able to roll over on us. And someone said a quote, I might slightly get it wrong, but it's something like, for evil to prevail requires that good people do nothing. And if we continue to do nothing and think that the government is going to solve a problem that the government created, we're fooling ourselves and we're giving away our power. Each one of us together as a group, when we stand together, and that's why we call this New Mexico Stands Up. We have Ohio Stands Up. We have Maine Stands Up. We have a lot of states joining us now. It's a grassroots movement for people to become empowered, to get educated, to do their own receiving this, you know, that would help.
So. I agree. The push to get the vaccines administered now is based upon emergency use authorization. All of the COVID vaccines were approved by the FDA based upon the vaccine companies who applied for emergency use. This meant that they were rapidly fast-tracked, and the companies were able to leap over regulatory hurdles to get the vaccines onto the market quicker. It also means that there was no rigorous review for safety and efficacy. Legally and ethically, why should we make efforts to bring a cessation to emergency use authorization rules?
Well, in this case, they are not actually approved. They're only allowed to be marketed, and they're allowed to now do human experimentation without really disclosing that that's what they're doing. And it goes against the Nuremberg Code. It goes against our own sense of morality and bodily integrity. These are dangerous medical interventions that I have the absolute right to refuse, because I have the right to decide what I do with my body as long as it doesn't harm anyone else. And since there's no proof that, you know, this is for the quote greater good, that's another fallacy that a lot of people have been programmed to think that they should give up their individuality for the greater good. Well, it's not even shown to do that, because it doesn't prevent transmission to anyone else. It doesn't prevent you from getting it. So this whole scheme of how you can have an emergency use authorization is based in part upon a declaration of an emergency. Well, they can declare an emergency, but what's the basis of it? We've already talked about there's really no basis for this emergency, because the numbers are false. This is not a pandemic. Even the World Health Organization changed the definition of pandemic just before this all happened. How convenient. You know, so many things have happened, and we are overcoming so much programming. This has been going on for years and years, and it suddenly escalated to a huge level that, you know, surpasses anything we ever read about in George Orwell's 1984. It's very Orwellian at this point.
One of the most important issues, and I don't know if you intend to include this in any of your investigations, is the most important of all, and it's not being touched by the mainstream media at all, and that is the origins of this. I've read probably every paper that has been published, along with Richard Gale, on the origins. And up to this point, it was all one voice. This was a natural occurring bat virus, probably infected a pig or some other animal, and was eaten at a, you know, purchased and then eaten from one of these markets close to Wuhan, and that's how it evolved. And yet one of the world's top research scientists on the evolutionary biological form that this takes said it's not humanly possible. They've done the review, and they compared this COVID virus to the first COVID virus, like two other COVID viruses, and they found that you cannot have that kind of genetic sequencing change that make it more lethal, just without a historical footprint. It doesn't follow any of the ways that something changes naturally, which takes a long time to do. Not a year, not 5 years, not 10 years. Frequently takes hundreds, even thousands of years. So then the question is, well, where could it evolve? And then we start finding, first from some whistleblowers in Wuhan themselves, who you don't see anymore. They've disappeared. We had about three or four, and they were all just dismissed out of hand, as all those are just conspiracy theories. They just want to say something that's political against China. No, these are people who are working, one of them working in the Wuhan lab, who came forward. There was one who died who gave his opinion. Two women came forward. And how do you not take these people seriously if they're willing to testify under oath and provide documentation? But nobody wanted to see their documentation. Nobody wanted to go that far. It was a question they did not want to have answered. As a lawyer, you know, you never ask a question of a person in court unless you already know the answer, because that door that you open can swing right back and hit you in the face, destroy your case. So no one in the media was asking these people, can you come in and bring all of your documentation? Now, as an award-winning investigative journalist who's broken over 300 stories in my career, I was the first person to break the story on the politics of cancer back in the early 1970s, showing how corrupt the cancer establishment was. And I've done a lot of subsequent original articles since then. I can tell you that people that I originally spoke with, it was when I sat with them and they started giving me documentation. And the documentation is what I believed. And the person giving it to me, whatever their ultimate motives, it was, is this information accurate? And if it is, then I have to go with it. You have not seen anyone that I'm aware of who's gone to any of the major media, or the major media going to any of these individuals and say, let's take a look at the evidence you claim to have. Now, if they can debunk that person, do so. If they can't, and you have evidence now you're sitting with that shows there is a conspiracy to cover this up, then you have to have the courage to go with that. Now, let's look at what we now can say with some authority. The winner of the Nobel Prize for discovering HIV virus was not who we were originally led to believe, and at the head of the AIDS parade was Robert Gallo. No, it was Luc Montagnier at the Institut Pasteur. He said, along with colleagues from the Institut Pasteur, this could not have been accidental or in nature. This was man-made. In fact, when they did their analysis, they found the DNA of some HIV in there. That means it was a gain-of-function weaponization of a virus. But several others have come forward saying that when we look carefully at the genome, the genetics, this is a gain-of-function. Now, in and of itself, that doesn't prove that it is. But now we have the President of the United States, at the time that this gain of research was done, that was Barack Obama, putting a moratorium on gain-of-function research. He said, no more. Behind his back, when Anthony Fauci and continued funding it, over $7 million, University of North Carolina. Now, the person who was handling all this was a man, Dr. Daszak. Now, he then works with the people at the University of North Carolina, but then he takes all this offshore to the Wuhan lab, where he had been working for, I believe, 10 to 15 years. High praise for the Chinese. They're perfect in what they do, no problems. But that's not the case, because 2 years before all this, the State Department investigation showed that there were so many lack of cautionary principles being used in safety at the lab that they should shut this down. And that's one of the things we believe that motivated Barack Obama to close this gain of function. Because gain of function is you're taking something and you're weaponizing, you're making it more powerful, more lethal. And what if you let that out by accident or intent? So now the World Health Organization, which is fully under the control of the Chinese government, and the man who heads it has no background in medicine or science. His PhD is, I believe, in philosophy. But boy, he is a supporter of China. So between the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Chinese government, that's who gives most of the money to the World Health Organization. And they have a long history of being wrong and political. So they say, well, let's do an investigation. They go there. There's a photo op shoot. There's no investigation in the lab itself. No affidavits taken, nothing like that. No samples of the original materials they were working on. And they come back and say, nothing to see here. Keep moving. But hold on. Who was the one who headed that? Dr. Daszak. Oh, you mean the same one who got all the money and was doing the research? Yes, the same one. Well, that's a gross conflict of interest. Of course it is. But he wasn't the only one engaged in conflict of interest. So now we have a lab that we can, in fact, one of the people, one of 26 scientists who signed a letter that none of the media have touched upon, saying we must have a completely honest, open investigation, and we don't have that right now. One of those scientists did the analysis and said that there's a 99.98% probability the virus originated at that lab. Mind you, he's one of the world's leading authorities. So why isn't the media covering this honestly? Why aren't they demanding a new impartial investigation? Because nobody wants to challenge China, and because it would reveal the truth. So what if it was revealed that, yes, this lab was working on the Wuhan lab was working on the virus as a gain-of-function research, but it was funded by Anthony Fauci and directed by one of Anthony Fauci's colleagues? That would mean that the person who helped cause this pandemic is the person overseeing it, Anthony Fauci. Imagine how quickly the house of cards would collapse. Your thoughts, please.
Well, what you have said sounds very shocking, I would imagine, to most people. But I actually put some of those facts in our December 21st filing complaint, which was later amended just because of we inadvertently put the minor's name, a child's name, without redacting it. But that was the only amendment. But we talked about gain of function research that had been done and the involvement that we found through our research that Dr. Fauci was involved in, and that he had been able to get millions, in fact, it might even be billions, I don't recall, but millions of dollars to that lab for gain of function research on bat coronaviruses. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that was the gain of function research on bat viruses. This has been, as you say, they have weaponized it. There is evidence that Fauci was involved, that maybe some other aspects of the U.S. government were involved. He was with the National Institute of Health, and the National Institute of Health is, pretty glove in hand with the CDC and the Human Health and Services Department. There's a lot of interwoven with these departments and agencies. So even though what you're saying, Gary, sounds very shocking to most people, it's consistent with some of the research that we have found. And I did put some of that in there because I want the court to think about this. There might be a bigger picture here than we're all aware of. We don't know what it is fully, but there are so many moving parts to this narrative. And what we're trying to do is get underneath the narrative, just like your journalism does, but get underneath it. What's really happening here? And I can't say I have all the answers, but we have certainly uncovered a lot of things that we're questioning more and more. And we keep doing that. We have a really great team of volunteer researchers who help me daily and have helped me put these massive lawsuits together. So, this is true. This there's a lot beneath the surface that never gets reported by mainstream media. And if you rely on mainstream media, you're going to be misinformed or uninformed, in my opinion.
You are right. Anna Gardner, thank you for your courage, because you know they're going to attack you. They're going to plant stories about you. They're going to do everything they can to destroy you, your will to go forward. And yet I'm hopeful that you will be a Danny Sheehan, a John Whitehead, those who stand up against the establishment at all cost and prevail. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Gary, for having me. I really, really am so pleased that we're getting the word out like this. Thank you.
And if you haven't received all of our recent articles on our investigative reporting, we will send them out to you today.
Great. I'd love to have them.
Anna Gardner, my guest today on the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening and have a nice day.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you crying.